Here we are. Nice to see you too. Let's do introductions, Sarah.
Ellie, Mimi, Judy, Violet, Nasrin,
Wendy,
John,
Yap,
Angie. So, in the Japanese tradition, and I'm certain the Chinese tradition of Buddhism, there's a great emphasis on ancestors. and especially in Buddhist practice, the lineage is understood as going all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, not in a way that comes with the passing of a piece of paper or a fancy rock or a crown or anything like that. It's called face-to-face transmission. So if Buddha, when he began to truly practice, was exposed to a whole new piece of information, you could say, about human life and how to enact this life in concert or integrated with the understanding of the wholeness of things. It's very hard to talk about what he actually saw, but his vision and his experience were so profound that he agreed with himself that it was important to share it with other people. And he did. And when other people had that same experience, then they told other people. And that's what the lineage is just other people telling all the way through the generations, generation after generation, so that although we have a fake list of the names, which is about 100 names going up to here, there are thousands back behind every single name that have been carrying this whole insight into the present moment. And so when we honor a teacher, it's to honor that insight which that brave person was willing to not only encounter and experience, but then open up as best as he or she could to others. So thinking about all those many others and how these powerful ideas and insights come to us creates a gratitude that in our practice we express at the death day as well as other days as a way of remembering where our own insights came from directly, face to face, with our teacher. So I thought I'd bring my teacher here. This is him. His name is Koben Chino Otogawa. And this is a collection of his talks that he gave at Sesshin, at one particular Sesshin, more or less, that Judy Cosgrove put together. And it's gives a very good picture of his mind and how he was able to express in a very quirky way the Buddha Dharma. He was born into a Zen temple, a very ancient, beautiful Zen temple. You can look it up online. It's called Jokoji, and it's in northern Japan. It's gorgeous, in a little village called Kamo. And he was taught Oryoki at the age of 3, using eating bowls, how to sit full lotus at the age of 3. Could just get into full lotus when he sits down. He doesn't even use his hands. He just goes, and then he's in it. he was trained by an old nun. It was a training temple then. His father was a great Zen master. And there were many monks and nuns living in a big dormitory to the left of the temple. And he said there was a mean nun. He said she was a mean nun who taught him to memorize the Lotus Sutra, which is as big as this book. It's just inconceivable to teach a little kid to recite the Lotus Sutra. They shaved his head at the age of 10, I think. And he said he got terribly teased at school. You know, he was strange and different. And he was a bit different anyway. So he said he was pickled in Zen, but he didn't like it very much. But he got very, very interested in Buddha, in what Buddha was talking about, almost in spite of himself. He felt there was something there that he should know about. So he went to university and studied with the great, great teachers there who, when he was completed, several of them begged him to stay and go further and become a teacher yourself here at Komosawa University. And he said, no, I have to find out for myself. He said, I know all what's in the books now. And he'd written a whole thesis on something about Buddha's mind. So he was supposed to know what it was all about. But he knew he didn't. Because Zen is an experience, not an idea. So he went to Eiheiji Monastery, which is the biggest and the greatest great monastery in Japan. And trained there. He got beaten to a pulp in the beginning because that's what they do to the new people. And suffered greatly. It's really, really hard. In the winter, it's terribly cold. The food is awful. well, it's very sparse and has very few not only calories, but vitamins. It's just not very healthy food. You're supposed to suffer. He said, they beat the ego out of me. When he, at the end, he actually completed his goal. His teacher called him home and said, okay, now you can be a teacher. Now you're transmitted. You're actually there. And sent him back to Eiheiji Monastery to train the new monks. And the first thing he did was to go to the abbot and ask permission not to use the stick and not to hit them. They were shocked. They'd always hit the new monks. They'd always beat them black and blue. And Kobun said, that's stupid. Why are we doing that? So he got permission, and he said there was just one monk he had to hit. At one point, he just had to hit him. He was an unusual character. He was highly respected at the monastery, and they expected him to go far in the Soto tradition. Soto Zen tradition. But he thought that America was really the best place, that there wasn't a bureaucracy in America. In Japan, Zen has been there for so long, it's very thick and heavy with bureaucracy. There are so many layers and levels of accomplished people who are all telling each other what to do, that it's just way top heavy. And the whole idea of Zazen gets pretty lost in there. So when he got a letter from Suzuki Roshi asking if he would like to come and help him, he just felt he'd died and gone to heaven. He went to his teacher, his old teacher, and said, "I've got this letter, and Master, may I go to America to help this wonderful monk? He's going to make a monastery in America." And his teacher looked at him and said, "No, you can't go." So he was deeply disappointed. And so he ended up helping his master in his master's temple, which was in the same little town where his own father's temple is, and asked him again, "Please, please?" And the master said, "No." And the third time he asked him, because that's the thing in Buddhism, like a lot of places, if you ask three times, usually on the third time somebody says yes. But his master said no the third time. And he went anyway. He just up and went because Suzuki Roshi wanted him. And he could go to America. So he managed to buy a very big Mokugyo. Do we have one? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's not here. A fish drum that are enormous for the new temple that Suzuki Roshi was going to make at the monastery. And it shipped it on the ship that he went to America on, and arrived in America without knowing any English, even though his master, with whom he'd lived for 15 years, teaches English in high school. I met the master, and he hardly knew any English at all. He could teach it, but it's not the same. Having studied Spanish, I know I can read it in a book, but I can't talk it. It's a whole different part of the brain. So he arrived and was asked to give talks at Tatsuhara and San Francisco Zen Center, and people laughed about it. Sometimes he would just fall asleep in the middle of a talk. He'd just be sort of vaguely out of it until he began to find his footing. He helped set up Tatsuhara, which to this day is a very beautiful and quite wonderful retreat center, not so far from here. I hope everybody has a chance to go there. If only to be a guest. That's how I ended up there, just as an accidental guest. And My husband and I used to take our friends there in the summer and just hang out, go to the hot baths, the wonderful hot baths there, and hike in the mountains and walk down the creek and swim in the creek. Beautiful place. But there's practice there too. And you hear the bells and the gongs and the bok, bok, bok of the han. What's there was helped very much by Koban. The language of the translations, he could do that. That was very helpful. He knew a lot of English to write. So our Heart Sutra that we chanted this morning was a lot of that was his translation. And Suzuki Roshi, after only a short time, just a few years, became very ill and asked Koban if he would take a little, it was a garage, a two-car garage in Los Altos, which is just up the road a little ways, in a suburb, pretty little suburb. And Suzuki Roshi used to go down once a week and teach there. And they'd set it all up with 17 zafus. And they called it haiku sendo for the 17 syllables in a haiku poem. So it was very romantic. And it was set up by some people who had studied with Suzuki Roshi at Stanford University. And they were amazing. Several of them were quite old ladies. And they had a tremendous amount of experience, not only in sitting, but in life. And added a lot of juice to the whole situation. And there were a lot of Stanford students who were coming there also. And so when Roshi died, before he died actually, he asked Koban to take responsibility for this little zendo, haiku zendo. And so that's how Koban ended up where he did as our teacher. And one day at Tassajara, when I was there with my friends, somebody said at the office, "Don't you know there's a Zen master just a mile or so from your house?" And I didn't know that. So he gave me his name and his number, and then I dithered for weeks. I was so... I thought, I can't do that. I'm just a housewife. I'm just taking care of my kids, you know. I'm not good enough to go there. Even though I'd gone to sit at Tassajara every time we were there, I would get up at 4 a.m. and sit with the students. When the Han went, I jumped out of bed. My husband kept thinking, "Wow, what's she doing? What's she doing?" But I would get up and go and sit. It was the first time that I'd really heard the Dharma when Suzuki Roshi gave talks. And I was so stricken in a way. I felt I'd been listening for my whole life to hear something like that. And he could speak it. So that's how Koban came into our life, because he came into my life in that strange way. And when I did go to Haiku Zendo one Wednesday night, and I sat opposite him just by chance, I came and just threw myself on the cushion. And when he was to give a talk, and he looked at me and caught my eye, and I just felt like I was slammed against the wall. Boom! And I came out thinking, "Oh, my goose is cooked. I'm done for. This is there's no help for this anymore. So that's kind of dramatic way of describing the encounter that happens sometimes with us as we meet the truth of things. So I thought I'd just read you a few things that he said in his own inimitable way, just because I like them. He said, during the last few nights, we discussed a very core issue of our practice, facing our own self, asking why we have come to this world and for what purpose our existence is shaped as a human body and mind. Trusting your own self, as well as giving full trust to others, is really, really hard. In your attempt to sit in one spot for hours and hours, day after day, there must be something you are working on. It's not a trifling matter. You're not a resting bird on a tree branch. You're not simply resting for a while on the cushion. Trust is contained in sitting. Stillness is another way to express what trust is. If you are lying down in bed imagining that you're on a mountain waiting to be hit by lightning, but you don't trust that you can face death that way, you will immediately jump up from bed and run away from the lightning. But this lightning was in your imagination. Actually, this life we are experiencing day by day is not something in your imagination, nor does it turn out just as you have imagined it would. In stillness, day after day, you have a new opportunity to see yourself. This one too. When we talk about trusting, about believing in something, or faith in something, we tend to think about this with a flavor of religion or a spiritual way. And yet, when you look into your daily activity, helping others, taking care of children or sick people, or working on making something for many, many days, you begin to understand what it means to have faith or trust. There is great power in it. The word power is probably not suitable, but the capacity to merge one's life force around or within others is what I'm talking about. An example would be if a person were to accidentally fall into a fast-flowing river and everyone panicked, wanting to go in, but looking at the tide of dark water, they immediately identified themselves with a person who was floating away. Oh, that's me. If I go in, I'd be just like that. The power or belief is when one knows how to swim such a current without hesitation, without fear, just jumps in and tries to add their force to this sinking force. Deep knowledge about things and skills trained into your system are the contents of your belief or confidence. He actually did that as a teenager when his best friend jumped into a river and started to float away, drowning, and he jumped in and saved him. He knew that way, and he passed away that way also. So he talks, this is called embracing mind. And he talks about sesshin as meaning embracing mind. But when we study the precepts, the three pure precepts that we accept are, his translation includes embracing as the key word. It's embracing us and sustaining right conduct. Usually it's expressed as I vow to be good or something like that. But embracing and sustaining right conduct is a whole different matter. The second one is embracing and sustaining every good. Embracing and sustaining every good. Embracing and sustaining all beings. Usually we say, in the way it's come to us in English, is save all sentient beings. And that has so many problems to it. But to embrace and sustain all beings turns it into something entirely understandable to us in a deeper way. We can't save anyone, but we can certainly embrace and sustain and reach out and help whatever needs it. There are many more things in here, but and many more subjects. He has a lot about transmission. He was not concerned about, I mean, he was concerned about transmission, and he made sure that we were transmitted as best we could be, meaning he would meet with us. He was willing to meet with us face to face and to help us in every way he could. But he was not so, he told us, please don't get involved with the Soto Zen people in Japan. He said, that's a mistake. And they actually came to Jikoji at a certain point when I was the director there. And these three gentlemen in suits and ties came and interviewed us, Koban and me, about Jikoji. How many students we had, how much money we had, how much money we needed, how much property we had. It was how much and how many of a certain kind of mind. And then they asked Koban, and now what can we do for you? And if they had done for us, the bishop is in L.A., the bishop who is in charge of, I think, West America, who keeps an eye on all the different Zen centers who are associated with Japanese Soto Zen. And they come and check it out and make sure you're doing it right. And so that's one of the reasons Koban did not want to be pinned down to a certain rigid standard. He thought Americans should create their own way, that it was a different culture, and that it was a fresh start. And to make it terribly Japanese was a big error. So when they asked what they could do for us, Koban thought for a long time, very quiet. He said, oh, Heiheiji Monastery puts out a very nice little magazine once a month. If you could put us on the mailing list, please. So for a long time we got this little magazine from Heiheiji Monastery, but that was the only request he made. So we still don't belong. I think Chikoji does. I think Chikoji belongs. Michael finally decided to join, but most of the rest of us have followed his and Copen's instructions and not hooked up with the Japanese side of things. But it's all a big question of how American Zen is going to go, if it's going to go. And it's all up to us, of course. We're encountering this, in one sense, culturally, it's a very new and different kind of way. It's very different from how I grew up in the Midwest. It's nothing like St. Louis, Missouri had to provide for any of us. But in another way, it's something everyone is already. So when we meet it, we recognize something. And it provides a space for us to cultivate what it is that we recognize, a safe space. And my view has always been to provide a space. That's why Chikoji got born, to have a space where people could safely come and practice. Who knows where it's going to go? We can't possibly know, though it irritates me sometimes that I don't get to know what happens next. It's obviously not going to happen that way, but it's important, I think, to consider the possibilities and to really study how religion has been developed all through human history. It all starts with an experience. If you look back, it's all based on somebody having a deep insight and then somehow passing it on. And at some point, somebody says, oh, we should have a place where we can all meet. And then we all meet in a place. And then somebody says, well, let's put up a little altar. And so somebody makes a little table and puts something on the altar, some beautiful stone or something. And then somebody says, we need a bigger house. We need a big house. And we should have a little gold in there somewhere because that's so beautiful and this is all about the visions. And pretty soon it gets very complicated and very fancy. If you go to Japan and expect to see a Zen temple being austere and plain and simple, it's not like that. Look up Joe Koji on the website and you will see it's all golden, beautiful, huge, golden, everything. Very, very beautiful and crazy in a way. It made me laugh when I walked in. It was not very polite, but I just laughed. Oh! This is what it is. So that's my story. And you may have some questions. There's time for that. Yup.
Thank you. I was wondering, since in California here, Suzuki Roshi and Koben are, you know, sort of the two figures who came over from Japan. If they had disagreements about certain elements of the teaching.
Oh, I'm sure they did. Yeah, I think they didn't like each other very much. Frankly, I'm not sure. I can't give you a reason, an excuse for what I think, but I'm pretty sure they really didn't like each other. I think Suzuki Roshi thought Koban was kind of off the wall. Yeah, he was considered by some to be just a little nuts, because he lived the Dharma in a way that was not practical. He was not at all practical. And when he did things, he did them in a sense of saving all sentient beings. I mean, when he picked up a spoon, it was a sentient being to him. When he served someone food, it was not just giving you something. It was giving you something. Everything he did was that way. He didn't just pick up something and then slap it down. He would never do that. He always had tremendous, deep respect for each thing that he handled. That too was an extension of Buddha nature itself, and you took care of it. You took infinitely good care of it. So, Suzuki Roshi was more practical, and while he was trying to decide who to put in charge of the Zen Center when he was dying, he assigned a businessman to be the next abbot and created a very un-Zen-like kind of atmosphere that actually came to grief, because this guy was a businessman and he was just a big operator. His license plate on his car said Zen. You know, big letters, Zen. And he was a naughty boy in a lot of ways too. So no, I don't think they got along very well. Though the Dharma coming from Suzuki Roshi was very clear and very good. I mean, that often happens, that you can become a teacher and not be the same as all the other teachers. Nobody is the same. There's a different flavor, different standard. And Koban's standard was very, very deep. I think Suzuki's was a little more practical. So they didn't quite respect each other. And so their students don't either. When I go to Tassajara, some people will be glad to see me and even show me their rock sues that Koban wrote on, because the abbot after Suzuki couldn't do that kind of writing and brought all the rock sues to Koban to write for them, and then take back to San Francisco and do this, then they would do the ceremony. So they would say, oh, look what Koban wrote, it's just beautiful. So it was like that. But there are others who are contemptuous. No, they just, Koban didn't amount to anything. He was just a loser. And he was. He always said, you know, if you're getting into this, you are a loser. You're giving up a lot. You're stepping down, he always said. You're not trying to get somewhere. You're stepping down. Thank you. Wendy?
So where did the giant fish drum end up?
It got burned up in the fire.
At Tassajara?
Yes. The whole Zendo burned down. It was associated with the kitchen, and the refrigerator caught fire. Burned the whole
forest fire.
No, it was early from that. No, they had a beautiful statue of Buddha also from Gandhara that was just gorgeous. And it's gone too. Yeah. So they built another one.
So maybe you could tell people about the memorial session.
Well, there is a memorial for Coben. What they're going to do is read from, not this book, I think, but from another book that Judy put together. They just pass the book around and everybody gets to read a paragraph. And that's next weekend. Is that right? I think so.
Last weekend?
Yes.
July.
Yes. So, I think it's Friday night to Sunday noon. And everybody's welcome to come. They often, they will probably have a procession at a certain point. And some of Coben's ashes are buried across the creek. You walk down through the forest and cross over and then go up. And in this little bower of trees, there is an overlook of the waterfall that Coben used to love to sit by. And so they have a stone that his brother sent from Japan with Coben's name and his little girl's name on it. And then we buried the ashes right at the bottom of the stone. So when you go, there's a bucket and a scoop, bucket of water and a scoop, and you scoop the water and you pour it over the stone and just create a little waterfall for them. And each person gets to do that during the procession. So go if you can. I can't take that walk anymore. Unfortunately. Judy?
Can you tell us the story of how you were transmitted?
I must have you did that question.
I know some people haven't heard it.
Well, he didn't know what to do with the women in his group. And he wanted to encourage us, and we would not let him not encourage us. We were all very strong and very determined. We just loved being there. And so we just kept turning up and doing things. And so at a certain point, it was a long process, actually. I first received a teaching stick after I'd been teaching at Chikoji. Only because he wasn't there. He would say he was coming and then he wouldn't come. And nobody else would do it, so I did it. And after a while, he did come. And he asked me to come up to the altar when he was doing a memorial service for somebody's grandpa. And he said, come and help me. So I said, okay. And I gave him the incense and there was this stick on the altar. And while he was doing all this stuff, he took the stick, ran it through the altar, and then gave it to me. Boom, like that. So that was my permission to teach. And then the transmission was that I had come down with cancer for the second time, much more seriously. And when I was recovering, he said to me, "You need to sew a robe." And I said, oh, okay. You know, if he told me to do something, I would do it. I didn't know robes from anything, but I said, fine, I will do this. And he said, go to Blanche, and Blanche is the sewing teacher at San Francisco, so you'll have to go and work with Blanche, which I did. And Blanche said, well, what color does he want? Well, it turns out that color is an extremely important aspect of practice in San Francisco, that if you have a blue roksu, that means you're the very first step that you've taken. If you have a black one, it means that you're a priest. If you have a brown one, it means you've been transmitted. And then if you have a purple one, it means you're an abbot. And then it's all your colors. You can read about it in Japanese tradition. It's just extremely elaborate. And we've never done that. Koban always handed out his roksus. You always get roksus when you're a teacher. People make them and give them to you. This was made for me in Arcata. So he said to Blanche, make it a brown one. And I thought, oh, that's right, because in Buddhist time, they just took scraps from the that nobody wanted anymore, that could not be used for anything else. You know, things that had wound up dead people or just sort of really icky, horrible things, and washed in the river, and then dyed a brownish earth kind of color. And I thought, that's absolutely perfect. So I went to the shop and I bought the cheapest brown cotton I could find, and I took it up to Green Gulch where Blanche was going to teach me. And they all just about fell over. They said, you're going to go brown robe. No, he must have made a mistake. This is wrong. They couldn't believe it. It was this little freckled-faced Midwesterner housewife doing a piece of brown fabric. But I had just finished radiation treatment, and I was feeling very weak and feeling like I had no idea whether I was going to live or die. And so I think that's why Koban did that for me. It was a huge gift. He just sent me up there to do nothing but sew all day long. Sew. You take refuge in Buddha with every stitch. You just put the needle in, namu, pull it out, kie, pull the whole thing out, butsu, plunging into the ocean of Buddha over and over and over. So I sewed and sewed and sewed, and in a week I had finished it, which, if you know about sewing robes, is kind of remarkable. But I just was so intent on making the most of life that I possibly could while I was there, and the practice. And then I gave it to Koban, because that's what you do. You wrap it all up, make a pretty package, and then you give it to your teacher. And then he's supposed to give it back to you in a ceremony that has papers involved and all kinds of interesting things that you're supposed to do. And nothing happened. And I just forgot about it. I thought, oh, well, it was just he was helping me because I thought I was dying. And so then we were in Sesshin, and somebody's grandma had died. And she asked him to do a ceremony for him. And he and Blanche was there, which was just by the by. And he did the ceremony, and then he asked me to come up there. I thought, oh, okay. And I jumped up and joined him, and he had the thing there. He had my little package after 3 years. And they took it out, and I put it on my head. We did the whole thing, and then they put it on me. And then I walked out with him in a daze, and he said, you know, it's not yours. It's not your robe. He said, if somebody from Japan comes and they've forgotten theirs, you can let them wear it. That's how he instructed me about this. So I had no idea what to do with it. And Blanche took me in hand. She was mad about it. She asked Coben, what kind of ceremony was that? And was that a real ceremony? And was it a lay ceremony or a priest ceremony? Or what was it? And Coben just said, Dogen said that even lay people can be transmitted. So that was not good enough for Blanche. She was grumpy to the end of her life about it. But she took me in hand and persuaded me to go with her to Japan and learn how to wear it. And made me wear it. Made me learn how to wrap it up and do all those things. And how to behave in a real temple. So I got a Zen Center training at the same time, which she knew Coben wasn't going to give me. But the real transmission was not in any of those places. That was just kind of by the way. And nobody even thought that I was transmitted in spite of receiving the robe until when I was leaving Jikoji, saying goodbye to the whole project. There was a little gathering like this, a tiny gathering, and they gave me a present. And Coben said, I just never believed there could be a house transmitted housewife until I met you. So I left in dudgeon. I was so annoyed. I thought, why? But I'm more than a housewife, or I'm less than a housewife. I'm not a housewife. It was just a typical thing that you go through with, or we went through with him. He just would not stay on a line that you thought he should be on. But I had many, many meetings with him, many, many teachings on many levels, many very different levels. He would sometimes just show me something and not explain it. He would just show it to me. Or he would explain something on his hands like this, like that, and I would go home and write it all down, what he had said, so I could take it in. It was a long process, actually. Thank you. It's just about 2 o'clock, so we should carry on with the silence. Thank you all. Thank you very much.